Welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Hello, and welcome to another exhilarating episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. And coming up on this week's episode, we have a great interview with Neil Giantoli. He is playing Mayor Daley, that's Richard J. Daley, in the new show His Honor at Prop Theater. Also, we have four more reviews from Chicago critic Tom Williams. And of course, as always, I'll be bringing you the theater news. So grab a seat, or stand up, it doesn't matter. But just relax and get ready to talk some theater. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, giving you the news for the week of March 13th, 2006. The Color Purple is coming to Chicago. That's right, the producers of The Color Purple have announced that the national tour of the Broadway smash hit musical will premiere in April of 2007 at Chicago's Cadillac Palace Theater. This long-run engagement will have an initial block of tickets on sale through June of 2007, and the Chicago run will be followed by engagement in other major cities across the country. As on Broadway, the production will be directed by Chicago native Gary Griffin. Tour casting will be announced at a later date. Mattel and Live Nation have announced that actress Erin Elizabeth Kors has been cast in the lead role of Barbie in the elaborate stage production of Barbie Live in Fairytopia. Barbie, the doll with a too-good-to-be-true figure, wardrobe, and array of careers, is taking human form for the first time. Erin Elizabeth Kors, from Cincinnati, Ohio, will bring Barbie to life on stage for the first time ever in a touring live theatrical stage show coming to Chicago's Auditorium Theater April 11th through April 16th. The 24-year-old Kent State University graduate called the role a girl's dream come true. The producers of Pirate Queen, an epic tale from the writers of Les Miserables and Miss Saigon, have announced that Stephanie J. Block, the former Elphaba in the national tour of Wicked, will star in the pre-Broadway debut in Chicago this fall. The show, which will begin performances October 3, 2006 at Chicago's Cadillac Palace Theater, tells the story of Grace O'Malley, a spirited Irish clan leader who resists the English domination of Ireland. The Pirate Queen will be directed by Steppenwolf Theater Company's Frank Galati. Lifeline Theater has announced three world premiere stage adaptations for its 2006-2007 season. A Room with a View, running October 13th through December 3rd, will be the E.M. Forster classic about an Englishwoman's trip to Florence, Italy. From February 2nd to March 25th, The Piano Tuner, Daniel Mason's bestseller about an Englishman who meets a mysterious military surgeon. And finally, from May 4th to June 24th, Crossing California, Chicago's Adam Langer's coming-of-age story set in the late 1970s Rogers Park. TV star Bea Arthur will be returning to town with her popular one-person show, Just Between Friends. The show will have one performance and one performance only on March 19th at 4 o'clock at the South Suburban Center for the Performing Arts at Governor State University. Try not to miss it. Hold on to your samurai swords. Producers Bob and Harvey Weinstein have snagged the rights to the books that inspired the film Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, according to Variety. the two hope to create a stage version of the martial arts film, as well as turning the five-book series into four new movies as well. Harvey Weinstein told Variety that the project would be a combination spectacle and musical with a cohesive storyline. A little bit of Cirque du Soleil with an emphasis on martial arts. Well, guys, Chicago's ready. Bring it on. Congratulations to Steppenwolf Theater Ensemble member Eric Simonson, who won an Oscar this past Sunday night for A Note of Triumph, The Golden Age of Norman Corwin. He took home a golden statuette for the Best Documentary Short Subject. Congratulations, Eric Simonson. Also, congratulations to the newest artistic associates for the Congo Square Theater. Derek Sanders, the artistic director, announced Daniel Bryant, Ron Connor, Erica Ratcliffe, and Alexis J. Rogers as their newest members. Congratulations again. For more information, go to TalkTheaterInChicago.com's Theater News section. I'm Dustin Moat. This has been Talk Theater in Chicago's News Podcast.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here is my review of Angels in America, a gay fantasy on national themes, Part 1, Millennium Approaches, by Tony Kushner, directed by Sean Graney, in a co-production by the Hypocrites Theater Company in association with Bailiwick Repertory Theater. Graney's Angels in America is powerful, profound, and stunning, a work of theatrical magic. I considered Angels in America, both parts, as the greatest play or plays of the last half of the 20th century. Tony Kushner's masterwork won the Tony Award in 93 and 94, the Pulitzer Prize in 93, and almost every theatrical award offered. This brilliant, complex, and benumbing political drama is a true epic as it scales time, space, while including three storylines with several dozen characters. The play deals with AIDS, homosexuality in the mid-80s, when personal identity became muddled as being Jewish, a Mormon, or a WASP, or being gay or a black man can divide either of us or be the basis of a strong sense of community. This highly charged drama rivets us with its scathing attack not only on the right-wing conservative Republicans, but also admonishes the left-wing liberals for being much too docile. Kushner hates to see us treading water politically when we keep the equilibrium and preserve the past. Radical change is needed, according to Kushner, and it begins with action towards change in personal identity and the change in our view of what makes our society and our wider community. Angels in America may seem like a bleak play, but on second thought, it is about hope, and Kushner offers a dose of political optimism in this play. Director Sean Graney, while steadfast to Tony Kushner's vision, has mounted an easy-to-follow, quickly paced production of a complex, dense work that has baffled many a director. Graney gets it right here, as he uses effectively two video screens, square banks of lighting that constantly change colors for each scene, magnificent lighting work by Jared Moore, together with mood-setting sound designed by Michael Griggs and Mikhail Faisal that set the tones magnificently. The use of lighting and sound really underscores and adds power to this show. The ending sounds were chilling and breathtaking when the angel appears. This is a tremendous scene, and kudos to the production staff for the fine work. You'd be hard-pressed to find a finer cast than Graney has assembled for this non-equity production. The story revolves around two couples, the WASP Prior Walter, played nicely by Scott Bradley, and the Jewish Louis Ironson, who is played by Steve Wilson. They are gay lovers, together for more than 4 years. Prior is a former drag queen, and Louis is the politically charged office clerk. When Pryor announces he has AIDS, Lewis, out of fear and helplessness, eventually abandons Pryor. The young Mormon couple, Joe Pitt, played by J.B. Waterman, a young attorney, and his pill-popping, mentally ill wife, Harper, played by Michelle Moe, are more buddies than married couple. Harper has hallucinations about the ozone layer and Antarctica. Joe gets an offer to serve in the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. by Roy Cohen, played marvelously by Kurt Ehrman. Roy Cohen, who is the nasty power broker New York attorney with major political connections. The couples become intertwined when Joe runs into Lewis crying in the men's room. The two talk, and Lewis detects that Joe is an in-the-closet gay man. Pryor and Harper meet while both are having a drug-induced hallucination. Pryor tells Harper his revelation that Joe is gay, and Harper tells Pryor that deep down inside he is disease-free. As Pryor's AIDS gets worse, Lewis leaves him, since he is unable to cope with his fear. Only the former drag queen and nurse, Belize, played by Clifford London, is around to comfort Pryor. Joe and Harper grow further apart as Harper refuses to move to Washington, D.C., and Joe's sexual feelings begin to overwhelm him. Pryor's hallucinations produce two Walter ancestors who had come to prepare Pryor for the coming messenger. This reinforces the voices that he hears. Roy Cohen and his doctors spar over Roy's illness as the doctor tells him that he has AIDS. Roy argues, on the contrary, that just because he has sex with boys doesn't mean he's gay, and that he really has, quote, liver cancer. Roy feels that labels can hurt, and Roy will not give in to the weakness society places on some labels. Roy is haunted by the ghost of Ethel Rosenberg, whom he helped get executed. When Joe turns down Roy's offer to work in the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., after learning about Roy's unethical behavior in the Rosenberg case, Joe is called a sissy by Roy. Joe calls his mother, Hannah, who played by Donna McGowan, late one night, and he announces that he's gay. Hannah quickly sells her Salt Lake City house as she moves to New York to, quote, make things right with Joe. Joe and Lewis meet in the park, and sparks fly, leading them to having sex at Lewis's apartment that evening. Pryor hears voices, has prophetic visions as thunderous sounds and the haunting voices of the messenger who makes a spectacular appearance announcing, "The great work begins." This amazing show is so engrossing, so filled with rich lyrical language and emotional performances that you'll be on the edge of your seat, totally transfixed with this epic drama. Listen to the text. See both parts separately and then see them on the same day to get the complete message of this tremendous yet complicated play. Kushner has much to say, and Graney's production gives it clarity with a steady mounting dramatic tension that engages us throughout. This is a terrific production of a great play. The cast was splendid, especially Michelle Moe as Harper, Kurt Ehrman as Roy Cohen, and Scott Bradley as Pryor. These performers left it all out on the stage as they exuded the angst, the fear, the pain associated with their characters. I have seen several terrific productions of Angels in America, and I must say that Sean Graney's is among the finest, most riveting productions I have witnessed yet. This is excellent theater. For only $25 or $40 for both shows, you'll not find a finer theater value. I can't wait for part two, Perestroika. Thanks, Sean, for a terrific night of theater. My rating on this show, not to be missed. It is produced by the Hypocrites Theater Company in association with Bailiwick Repertory. It is at the Bailiwick Repertory's space, which is at 1229 West Belmont in Chicago. The play runs Thursdays and Fridays at 7:30, Saturdays at 3 and 7:30, Sundays at 3 p.m. The running time is 3 hours 15 minutes with two intermissions. It runs through May 7th, and it will be in repertory with Part 2 beginning on April 8th. For more information, call 773-883-1090. That's 773-883-1090. Thank you. See you next time. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here is my review of His Honor by Neil Giantoli, directed by Stefan Brun at Prop Theater. His Honor captures the essence of Richard J. Daley effectively. Prop Theater celebrates their 25th anniversary with an original world premiere, His Honor, written and starring Neil Giantoli. This play aptly captures the real Mayor Daley, who lived from 1902 to 1976, who was the last big city political boss. He was mayor of Chicago from 1955 to the end of 1975. He ran the last of the strong Democratic political machines. Daley was credited with putting Kennedy in the White House by producing tremendous support for the Irish candidate through his aggressive, corrupt political organization. Few mayors can call the White House and get JFK or LBJ to talk to them quickly. His Honor could, and Daley was all about power. I have memories of Mayor Daley, beginning with him ordering the air raid sirens to wail at 10:30 p.m. on the night his beloved Chicago White Sox won the 1959 pennant. I enjoyed this outspoken, tantrum-filled press conferences that Daley used to give. His amazing misuse of language, full of D's and do's and tree for tree. Daley was an American anachronism. He understood and used power befitting a pharaoh. Personally honest, religious, he attended Mass every day, and the play aptly starts out with Daley kneeling down and saying his daily prayers at a Mass service. He was also a family man. Richard J. Daley believed that Chicago was his city, and he ran it like it was his fiefdom. Neil Giantoli not only wrote a terrific play, a fine personal look at His Honor, but he was uncannily and quite believable as the mayor. This guy has the mayor down. He even looks like the mayor, particularly his face and his body language. He looks somewhat like Daley. His speech and his personal mannerisms were amazingly accurate. Giantoli certainly covered all aspects of Daley, including his famous charm, his good manners, and of course his ferocious temper. Giantoli deftly shows Daley's tender side with his family and also the coldness that he can project when one of his lieutenants gets caught in corruption. Giantoli depicts Daley as an enigma, part loving family man, part egomaniac, completely power-driven, devout Catholic, racist, prone to fascist actions. The complex man presented warts and all, and I think that worked very well. This is neither an anti-Daley nor is it a homage to him. This is a personal look at the man who seemed bewildered with the chaos that happened in 1968 with the King riots, with the Democratic National Convention demonstrations. We see Daley overreact as his protective actions to secure the city seemed paranoid. How dare the demonstrators invade his city? This utter disregard of civil liberties is well documented, and the play aptly shows that side of the mayor. The play is aided with Michael Dawson's video projections, which were a little out of focus, and certainly as the show grows and gets remounted, I'm sure they will clean that up and make that a little better, but it still works. And Joe Tesh's sound design with graphically illustrated the historical events surrounding Daley's time. Director Stefan Brun keeps the story rolling nicely. William Bullion as Matt Danaher, and Whit Surgeon as Tom Keene, and Nick Leininger as Danny Cooley offered excellent supporting work. The high point of this biodrama comes from His Honor's famous press conferences. Giantoli marvelously uses Daley's own words with skill as he smartly delivers the Daley style, phrasing and physical gestures so realistically that I thought I was on the fifth floor of City Hall with His Honor. His contempt for the press was evident in these scenes. The play got me thinking about the King riots and the Democratic Convention of 1968 when I was with the 333rd Military Police Battalion of the Illinois National Guard. I saw firsthand the Chicago police go wild on the hippie demonstrators in Lincoln Park and Grant Parks on orders from Daley. Playwright Giantoli borrows from and talks about newspaper columnist Mike Royko, whose book Boss was also about Daley. and he did his homework on this play. Giuntoli showed that he is not only a top actor, but an excellent playwright. This is a fine profile of an interesting man. This Frank looked at the Chicago icon, who loved Chicago, comes through loud and clear. And, of course, the power of this man who knew how to wield power comes across also. I wonder if Richard M. Daley, the present mayor of Chicago, will come and see this play. If he does, I'm betting he'll admire the honesty of the script and Giuntoli's accurate portrayal of his honor, even if he won't say so publicly. Please do come see the show, Mr. Mayor. I think you'll have a deja vu experience. His Honor is a smart, honest biography of a Chicago original. My rating for this play, highly recommended. And let me add here that it is so befitting Chicago Theater to take on the role of giving some of the history back of Chicago. And many people were very much afraid of writing a play about Daley because they weren't sure which way to do it. And it took a man who has told me that he really admired and loved Richard J. to write a play that comes off as not only a work of theatrical magnificence, but an honest portrayal of a man who was controversial and who was a little bit of a tragic figure at the end. But I think this play is worth seeing, and I think as the word gets out, this play is going to have a long run. Thank you very much for producing a strong play about Chicago. It is at Prop Theater, 3502 North Elston Avenue in Chicago. Tickets are $25. The show runs Thursday through Saturday at 8, Sundays at 3. The running time is 2 hours and 10 minutes with intermission. It's on a limited open run. For tickets, call 773-539-7838. That's 773-539-7838. Thank you. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here is my review of Accelerando by Lisa Lohmer, directed by Brandon Ray, produced by New Leaf Theater. Accelerando is more than just a boy meets girl play. New Leaf Theater has produced several quirky, well-performed shows over the last few years. Their latest, Accelerando, is a stylistic, multimedia romantic comedy with a refreshingly different take on the classic boy-meets-girl play. This relationship between love and time is explored in a funny, smartly written show that is part fable, part fantasy, grounded with unusual staging with effective use of mime, video projection, and direct discourse with the audience. I like this funny off-the-wall comedy that features a classical musician and a filmmaker, played by Michael Durting, whose passion for art overwhelms him. She, played by Georgianne Charouis, is a dancer seeking love. She uses the calendar to cover the history of mankind as she tries to come up with some meaning with the effects of time. This is an interesting aside that they do in the opening monologue that Georgianne Charouis gives, which was magnificent, stating one of the themes of the play is how love and time, the relationship, when you're in love, what happens to time? Interesting take. Playwright Lisa Lohmer shows the relationship of love, time, art, and history as we see that when we are in love, time stands still, or does it? The two mothers interrupt the two lovers who spend much of the show in the bedroom. Both are haunted by the nightmares of past loves and their nagging mothers. Time moves so fast that a nighttime romp can become a lifetime of pleasure. With terrific chorus work, underscoring the action by Tiffany Joy Ross, and the fine work from Isabel Quintero as Mamie, she's mother, and Annie Silovinsky as he's mother, Accelerando unfolds as a sexy, cute, quite provocative love story. We hear personal monologues from he and from she as the two explore the temptations of love from the time they meet to the seduction to the wild sex that they have to thoughts of long-term relationship, all happening in a single evening. The struggle between our accomplishments and our relationships is interestingly presented in this romantic comedy. While a funny show, Accelerando has layers of themes and multi-meanings that are presented quite theatrically here. This is a play that gets you thinking. This is provocative theater at its best. Terrific technical work. Kudos to sound director Nick Keenan, to lighting by Jared Moore, and Matthew J. Menaford's projections design all give this show a lot of depth and make it visually a nice-looking show. Together with the brisk pacing and effective ensemble work by the actors, especially Michael Durting and Isabel Quintero, who I thought were outstanding, make this a delightfully weird romance. They make it into a treat. Our disconnect, frantic-paced lives are satirized as a wake-up call here. This show gives us a relationship that sometimes we live life so much in the fast lane we just don't have time to enjoy it. That, I think, is the underlying theme of this show. And the ultimate question when you want to see this show is, do they become a couple, or is this strictly a one-night stand? See this show and find out for yourself. You'll enjoy this funny, imaginative play. I know I did. My recommendation, this is a recommended show. It's Accelerando. It's at the Lincoln Park Cultural Center, 2045 North Lincoln Park West in Chicago. Tickets are $15. The show runs Thursday through Saturdays at 7:30. The running time is 2 hours with intermission. The show runs through April 8th. Call 773-274-9026. That's 773-274-9026. Thank you. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here is my review of The Laramie Project by Moses Kaufman and the members of the Tectonic Theater Project, directed by Sean Hargadin, produced by Janus Theater Company. The Laramie Project packs a wallop. Janus Theater's 8-member ensemble landed the powerful, heart-wrenching saga of the horrible hate crime against Matthew Shepard in Laramie, Wyoming in 1998. This famous and saddening story of homophobia gone to extremes is told through the eyes of the Tectonic Theater Project under Moses Kaufman's leadership. The company traveled 6 times to Laramie, Wyoming, and conducted over 200 interviews with everyone involved in the crime, from town residents to law enforcement officials to religious leaders, covering the complete story in a slick documentary style. Matthew Shepard was kidnapped, tortured, and killed by 2 21-year-old men simply because he was gay. Lynn Wirth, Jeremy Schaefer, Seth Remington, Zachary Clark, Laura Schwartz, Jonathan Shelby, Karen Pappas, and Helen Young deftly play the dozens of characters using first-person narrative that aptly told the story with enough background and local color to give context to how and why this terrible crime happened. This is an amazingly well-performed show, showcasing the versatility and talent of the 8-member ensemble. This documentary style completely covers Matthew Shepard's story that unfolds as a powerful journalism and as an emotionally strong theater. This approach contains a look into the lowly depths that humans can reach when fear, ignorance, and bigotry are allowed to exist. It is also kind of an attack on small-town America and the narrow-mindedness that you can find in the rural lands. Kudos to the cast and director for mounting a fast-paced, sincere, energetic telling of a story that needs to be heard often so that it will not be repeated again. The talent of this ensemble is evident as they let the power of the story lead us into compassion for the victim and rage against bigotry. This is a polished production of an American tragedy. I think Matthew Shepard would appreciate the dedication of Janus Theater's ensemble. My rating for this show, recommended. It is at the Athenaeum Theater, 2936 North Southport in Chicago. Tickets are $15. The show runs Thursday through Saturday at 8 p.m., Sunday at 3 p.m. It runs through March 19th. Call 312-902-1500. That's 312-902-1500 for tickets. Hello and welcome. You are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our special guest this week from Prop Theater is Neil Gentile, who is the author and the star of one of the great shows that we have seen this year, one of those little sleepers, a little storefront theater. The show is called His Honor, and it's about Richard J. Daley, who was mayor of Chicago from, well, let me first say hello to Neil, and he can fill that in. Hello, Neil.
Hi, how are you? He was mayor from 1955 till December 20th, 1976.
And a lot of people that saw the show, and I saw it on Saturday, and by the way, your show is really doing well.
Thank you so much.
Let me ask you this now. It is so rare for someone to write a show and to star in the show. And folks, this guy has Daley down. He even looks like him. So tell us about how His Honor came to be.
I was doing a Walker Texas Rangers spinoff in 98, and I was playing a Chicago detective, kind of, you know, the kind of sergeant that'll break your chops about something. And I said, put me in a beautiful Armani suit. And they did, and I got in this beautiful suit, and I looked in the mirror. I said, you look like a Daley.
Is that what gave you the inspiration?
Physical inspiration, because I realized, you know, I used to be a skinny lad. And in 98, I wasn't skinny anymore, and I was older, and I just had that look about me. And I always put it in the back of my mind. And then in 2004, we have the National Plays, a new National Plays network through the prop, through my theater. And I said, what if I do a Daley play? And I was encouraged to do that. So then I just began to write it in August 2004. And I wanted to give it, I knew I wanted to give it kind of a West Wing flavor. And so I got the first 4 years of West Wing, the Aaron Sorkin years. And I just watched those to be aware of the kind of flavoring I wanted for the composition of the show. I wanted it to be fast-paced and interesting.
Well, you certainly accomplished that. And one of the things that strikes all of us who live through Daley is how even-handed you were about it. It isn't a pro-Daley and it isn't an anti-Daley. It's not a parody or a satire. When you gave the first press conference, it was like I was back there. It was scary.
Well, what I didn't want to do was I didn't want to be an apologist for the mayor, the late mayor, nor am I some left-wing ideologue, you know, with an ideological axe to grind. I want to entertain an audience. You know, and one thing also I said to myself was I'm not going to teach a history lesson. It's not going to be exactly correct. I'm here to entertain you. I'm here not to let you get bored. And I also wanted to write a love letter to the city. You know, I really do love this city. I understand. Every time I drive around, you know, and look around and see things, I understand the love he had for this place.
You were telling me earlier that you moved from Chicago after being one of the early members of Prop Theater, which is now, congratulations, celebrating your 25th year. Great show to do on your 25th year. Give us the background. You moved away to L.A. for a number of years.
I was John McNaughton, who directed Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, hired me for 6 weeks out in L.A. to do this little science fiction horror picture called The Borrower. And they paid me the royal sum of $1,400 a week. So I went out there for 6 weeks, and I was going to come right back home. But then I got another role on a TV movie that paid me even more money. And so that's when I called my boy's mother up, and we decided to move out to L.A. in 1989.
And all right, so give us some of the shows you did in L.A., because a lot of people, myself included, we know you were from Chicago, but that we hadn't seen you in a while.
Right, I did Memphis Belle. It was a World War II picture. And I've done so many TV shows, ER, Seinfeld, Chicago, Hope, NYPD, Blue, CSIs. I forget, there's a bunch of CSIs. I've done a few of the, you know, different ones. And I lived in a very little rural community called Topanga, and that's where I wrote the script. I started writing the script in August 2004.
All right, and what was your approach, Joe? What kind of research did you do?
I read everything. I read everything, and I watched everything that had ever been written on the mat, including I read a little tiny psychological profile that was in the library. Hidden in the archives, and it was done in 77, And it talked about his father. It talked about his father who was blackballed for trying to organize the sheet metal workers. And for some reason, that stuck out at me. And that's why I chose some of the... There's little remembrances that I go on. I don't know if they're correct, but...
And so you think that helped shape Mayor Daley in terms of him realizing, as a lot of the Irish did when they came here, that they better get in power. And since his father was blackballed, that was one of his motivations for becoming mayor and being as strong as he was.
And I believe right, and I believe his father was a definite influence in his life. They didn't talk much about his father, but they talked about his mother being a firebrand who was a suffragette. She wanted women to get the vote, and she was very much a force at Nativity of Our Lord Parish there. And he was a very well-dressed young man because he was an only child, which was also rare in those days. And I think she influenced him quite a lot. Both of them did.
I love the way you opened the show with him in church, because that was part of kind of the contradiction or the enigma that was Daley, that he was this devout man who went to church every day. Isn't that correct?
That's what attracted me to the whole process at first, was because, you know, an actor is supposed to believe who they are, yeah. Okay. And if somebody came to me right now, Neil, and said, I've said this before on interviews, and said, you're the mayor of Chicago, 3.5 million people, I'm telling you, I would start every day off on my knees. not necessarily in mass, but definitely in deep prayer, saying, God, help me.
But I mean, the contradiction of being this very devout man, and he was really kind of a square, right? He was not in politics for money. He loved the city. He didn't womanize. He wasn't a drinker. He would go home every night. I guess his big thing was going to the White Sox game.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, it was. He loved going there with his kids. They had 10 seats, and I read that the boys would say, this, the girls too, that this was, they loved those games because they would each get time to sit next to Dad and just to talk to him about anything. And one night I was at a Dodgers game with my son last year, and it was one of those perfect little evenings, you know, midsummer night evening. And we're just sitting there with my arms around him, and it just suddenly occurred to me, this is what life is. This is what life is all about, these little moments. And that's when I was able to zero in on that one moment near the end there where he talks about what a wonderful time he had at the Sox game.
And I thought the other moment that you caught the side of Daley that we don't normally see is when he makes the call to Richie during the riots. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was a fictional device I wanted because I was trying to grope for how this man would feel in the midst of what I lived through and personally impacted my own life. My great uncle, who was very dear to me, was driving in the wrong place at the wrong time. He got ripped out of his car and beaten to death during the Dr. King riot, except it took him 7 months to die. It was a very scary time. Many cities were alight at that time. That was a very bad year, and I really wanted to deal with that year, and I wanted to show Daley as a man.
Well, that was a very touching scene when for the first time probably ever, he didn't come home. He called home and said he was going to stay in the office to see what was going on. And then he wanted to tell Richie to be the man of the family, right?
It was indicative to the passing of the torch that we see now. We see, you know, his son, his boy, Richie, leading the city. And, you know, I have a 10-year-old, and that's very touching for me because, you know, I pray for my boy every day. You know, we try to raise our kids to the best of our ability, but we don't know what's going to happen. And he would be very proud of his son right now, I believe.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you have any apprehensions about, since you wrote the script, about playing him?
You know, it's funny you should say that. You know, the writer Rick Kogan, who's a good dear friend of mine, it was through him I met Mike Royko. I didn't tell you the time I met Mike Royko. I'll tell you that in a second. Rick was at the first readings we had in July of 05 down at the Cultural Center. And afterwards, Rick got up and said, this is brilliant. This is brilliant work. And he said, for 30 years, nobody has dared to take on such an icon. And right there when he said it, that's the first time that it hit me, like, uh-oh. And it didn't occur to me what I was doing. I was just plodding ahead and doing it. And I've never looked back and thought, what are you doing? You know, been scared or been doubtful. I think if I indulged in that sort of, I would be petrified and wouldn't be able to do it.
Well, I've been amazed, too, that not only has there not been a stage play, but there hasn't been like an HBO or a feature film about him. And I see you smiling when I mention feature film. Is that a possibility, you think?
You know, anything's possible. But people want to be entertained. That's what they want. They want to be moved.
Well, I'll tell you, this show moves it, and how accurately you depict him, because you show that he was a gentleman, but you also show when he would get mad. I think everyone needs to get out to see His Honor, because I think it's a terrific place. Now, here's a good place for you to do a little pitch for the show or a little commercial for the show. Tell us where it's at and what days it's playing.
Oh, of course. We're Thursdays, Fridays, Saturday at 8 p.m. Sundays, we have a 3 o'clock performance matinee. We're at 3502 North Elston. That's Elston and Addison. We're south of Addison, right near that White Castle when you're on your way to Wrigley Field, if that's where you're going.
White Castle and Wrigley Field are two good beacons that people can find. It's easy parking here.
Easy parking here, good neighborhood. You can buy tickets by going to ticketweb.com or to the Prop Theater, proptheatr.org.
Now, give us a couple of anecdotes, because the way you presented Daly, it was so realistic. Not only do you have his look, his gestures down, and I put a picture, an older picture of Daly, and then there's a couple of pictures of you there, and it's amazing how much you look like him.
I can't believe it. I mean, it's one of the anecdotes is that he would never call a Royko. He would always call people in power and beef at them about something that he didn't like that was read. And that's what we do early in the play. And the reason I put that early in the play was I wanted to establish the fact that he was mayor and that he had a temper and that he would not hesitate to call. The audience loves that call.
Give us, I'm not asking you to do an imitation, but give us a couple of lines as if you were, now, bingo, you're Daly now.
What I've always resisted doing, I don't mean this in any way, was, you know, a lot of a decision I made early on was I'll never take him out of there. And you're sitting in the theater lobby right now, and my hand is pointing towards the back. I'll never take him out of there. I'll never do an impression of him, and I don't mean anything bad by that at all. It's just that that's almost the sacred place back there. You know, and the way I feel about him was I want to honor him.
You really had respect for him.
Yes, sir. Oh, yes. Loved him very much. I mean, you know, you got to think about it this way was, you know, you have very few father figures in your life or heroes. And like I wrote in the program notes, you know, John Kennedy was dead. Bobby was gone. Dr. King was gone. The 1969 Cubs, they broke our hearts. He was the only one that was left. But he never seemed like he was like this far off, distant figure who you would see yelling at the press. The 9-year-old boy, I've never seen anybody do that in politics.
Yeah, and give short answers to complicated questions and get away with it.
Yeah, they truly, you know what's funny is, you know who I met the other day? It was so thrilling for me. It was Bill Cameron.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Cameron did something called Daly on the Record, and we put it on a CD, and that's what I play before the show, just to get the inflections of the late mayor on the, you know, down pat.
Folks, trust me on this. If you get the Prop Theater to see this amazing performer, you will be in the room with the mayor. I left there. That's all I was doing was thinking about the times I had seen him on television. And I was a big Daly fan in the sense that I got a kick out of him. You know, I was not sure whether or not I agreed everything he did. And it showed that, as Chris Jones of the Tribune mentioned in his rave about your show, that you presented Daly as sort of a tragic figure.
One of the things that you didn't agree with, one of the things I was thinking about was what I, Neil, would do at the 11 o'clock closing. Okay, I'm a parent, and if I tell my boy, you know, the bedtime is at 11, if I fudge from that, I've lost my currency with him. You know, because he'll know that he can argue his way out of a parental edict. And that's what I thought about the park, too. I don't know if I would violate the 11 p.m. closing rule. I don't know.
I think the accuracy, what you, it was very, very fair-handed script. I mean, you showed when he can, you know, some of the rough stuff he did, like the shoot the kill order. I like the way you approached that. And did you document that Conliss just decided not to do that? How did that come?
No,
tell us about that.
Dramatic license. I knew about O.W. Wilson, Superintendent Wilson. He was brought in as a reformer during the 1960 Somerdale scandal. to defuse the critics. And he came out with an order in 67, General Order 6714, that forbade the use of weapons in a riot situation. See, imagine, it's a thing of, okay, if I said to you right now, if I gave you that order, shoot any arsonist, and you got guys out on the line there, you know they're tired. You know what's going to happen.
And that's true. That if that order had been enforced, there would have been hundreds, maybe thousands killed, because guys were mad, they were scared. And this, given the volatility of the situation, I'm sure a lot of people would have fought back. Now you would have had a situation. So Connally showed not only a discretion, but guts to actually go against the mayor.
And like I said, I don't know precisely if that's what happened in the office there. That's what's called drama.
The fact is, the mayor did issue that order, and it didn't get down to the men. So somewhere along the line, somebody chose to disregard it.
Here's the thing was, I read in the Tribune, I think it was April 15th, 1968. The press conference was given then, 10 days after the riot started.
Yeah, I think he was, and the way you handled it, I thought that was great. It showed that he wasn't going to back down, but even he realized that it had calmed down. So to say it now, is shoot to kill, was more of a prevention. But he didn't do it at the time when tempers would have flared it. So I thought it was nice plotting on your part, and it came off quite believable.
Right. Well, that's what I thought. Why would he wait? And it was a very bizarre press conference. And I have personal reasons why it was a little bizarre. I don't want to go into, you know, right now. But, you know, I've been in similar circumstances where I've been stressed and have, you know, acted bizarrely, you know, or said bizarre things. And so he was a guy. Yes, he was the mayor, but he was also a guy. We're both guys. We're flawed.
Well, talk about his contradictions.
The two things that I read that would wind you in the doghouse with the mayor were marital infidelity, walking out on your wife, walking out on your family, and drunkenness. Corruption's concerned. If you would witness stuff in your days as a Chicago policeman, if you witness stuff in the station house, you're not going to go and, you know, you're not going to go to the guy and say, you better stop right now or I'm going to get you, I'm going to report you. You're not going to do that.
No, that's true. It's the code of silence. But if you are honest, you walk away. You don't want to know.
Yeah, that's what he was saying. That's what he said to the one guy. That's what he said to him saying to Tom Keene is, you know, there's going to come a point where my loyalty to a friend and my common sense come to a fork in the road. And at that point, I'm walking away from you.
Yeah, but none of them believed he would really do it, though, did they?
But he didn't, though. Did you see that in the end? He made a public profession. And that's accurate. And that's the Irish RC thing, too. See, I heard a fascinating story. I wish I had it for you. It was Jimmy Breslin talking on TV about how he was with the Humphrey people, and they had a meeting scheduled with the Daley people before the convention. And all of a sudden, the mayor's people got really cold towards him. And what they didn't realize is that the mayor was lukewarm about, you know, Vice President Humphrey and was courting Teddy. And he said, Breslin was saying, he goes, it's that Irish RC, meaning Roman Catholic. It's that Irish Roman Catholic thing. And that I just really enjoyed that a lot.
And I love the quote you have there when he calls Kennedy. And it's showing the power. As I said in my review, I said, how many big city mayors can call and get Kennedy on the phone or get LBJ on the phone? And they answer. And they'll be connected right to him.
None today. You know, it wouldn't be the mayor, our current mayor, you know, Richard M. I don't know him that well because I've been out of the city during his tenure, but I don't know if it would be his style. Right.
Now, I can tell you this, that we do see in the current mayor, we do see a little bit of the father in the good things.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love the city. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's, you know, Chicago, it's always been a tale of two Chicagos, though. It always has. You know that. And the golden Chicago is more golden than ever. It's unbelievable.
That's true. That's true. And
I love this city. I love this city.
Okay. Now, are you back here for good now, or
we're going to do a run so that everyone that wants to see this play can see it. You know, because if a tree falls in the woods and nobody hears it, did it fall? This is our home theater, you know, and it's a smaller theater. And it's a nice theater, and, you know, we'll see where we go from here. Now what we have to do is today, the day we're doing this interview is Tuesday, and Thursday I go back to work again. And it's show after show after show. And I want to treat each show and each audience as a particular blessed event, you know?
Well, let me ask you this now. With doing the many films you have done in television series, and now that you're back doing the live stage and playing an icon figure, really, what's the difference between doing film and television and doing the live stage?
Yeah, playing a king, the American equivalent of a king. The difference is that each show has the life of its own. It really does. And moments you'll hit on certain nights and certain nights you won't. And with TV, on the day when you film a scene, you might not have that magic moment. And once you do that scene, it's locked. It's done. You know, it's on film forever. So this I would say, is my most joyous moment. I'm having so much fun. You wouldn't believe it.
It comes off. And the homage that you and the entire cast are paying to this man, it's not an ode to Daly. It is Daly. But you can see the respect that you have for the man and how much you were enjoying it.
And I love the boys. I love the guys that are around me. What a great crew of guys.
Well, tell us about some of the... You have a terrific supporting cast.
Love them. Billy Bullion, he plays Matt Danaher. Whit Spurgeon, who plays Tom Keene. I have Dwight Eastman, who plays Superintendent Connellus. Nikki Leninger, who plays my young aide, Danny. Don Schroeder, who plays my old pal, Billy O'Donnell. Varick Douglas, who does a really good take on Jesse Jackson.
Yes, he does. He sounds like he had Jesse Jackson down, except he's about half the way to Jackson now.
Correct. That's correct. And I'm looking, I don't want to forget, and my dear brother Scott Vigil, who plays the priest, Gordon Gillespie, who he plays
Earl Bush.
Earl Bush, and does a great job at that. And James Eldrin Camp, who comes on as he comes on as the reporter, questioning. He has a really nice segment that. Then I also have him as this fictional lieutenant, Hofferman, a Red Squad.
I meant to ask you that because I thought that was fictional.
Oh, entirely.
But it's true though. You know, they did infiltrate.
They did infiltrate, and a lot of the things that I brought up were concerns that they had. And you know, the audience tittered when mention of poisoning the city's water supply. But, I mean, you know, consider post-9/11 now, you know.
Well, if you read the excerpts of the trials they did with Judge Hoffman, that was brought up. Now, I think that was a little paranoid of the city that, you know, technically would take, you know, get, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons of LSD to do it. But who knew at that time?
Nobody knew. And the mayor was... The mayor was particularly sensitive to any disturbances in the city, and I think...
Well, it was his city. I love the reference you made to it, and you didn't try and simplify it. You just let it lay out there when people were saying, you mean the city, and he says, no, I mean my city.
He did consider that.
Yeah, it's a Gaelic term in this little psychological study that I read in the main library archives. There's a Gaelic word called tuath, which means village. And he had that, you know, that proprietary sense of this being his tuath. And in many ways, I believe every Chicagoan is separated by only 6 degrees. We are the largest farm town you'll ever see in your life. I guarantee you and I know similar people. And so that's, I think, you know, that convention event didn't happen in a vacuum. It was definitely tied to the events of Tet Offensive, and then the assassination of Dr. King and the riots and Bobby being murdered. All those events just tied into one and led to that reaction at the convention event.
Yeah, and I love your line when he talks to Teddy and he offers him, I'll get behind you, and Teddy says, I don't want to get killed. I think he said that several times.
I think he said that. So some of the stuff, you know, when you read everything and just start reading stuff and you start writing, you can't remember. I think he actually did say that line.
But it was very effective the way you did it in the show. And then he ended up with Humphrey, who he was, like you said, lukewarm to.
Lukewarm to. And you know, the nation was tired of the Democratic Party's policies in Vietnam. Not that, you know, President Nixon was going to get us out, but it was a bad time. You remember that.
Yes, I do. And I love when Daly talks about the war when it came home, when he said he went to all the the wakes. Again, an Irish thing, but I saw some real tears in you when you did some of the scenes. You really get, I mean, it gave me goosebumps. It's really, folks, one of the great performances we'll see this year.
Thank you so much.
And I can see that you were Jeff recommended.
Yes.
Which
I love all of that stuff very much. Any kind of encouragement or assessment that somebody has of your work that is good, I love that. Thank you. When you give me kind words, I don't take them lightly. Words of encouragement. You know, if we could do anything for one another, just besides just like loving one another and being nice, it's encourage one another. I believe that.
Let me ask you this. What is your process for becoming the mayor, you know, in preparation for a night show? Like you say, you'll be back to work Thursday night. Give us a little bit of how you get in character.
Sure. I shower. I know that sounds weird. I shower, and I have a very extensive cologne cabinet, and I go through a whole thing where I select a cologne for the evening and, you know, get all gussied up and immaculately dressed like the mayor was. And all the while I have Bill Cameron's, Daily on the Record playing. And then I have a pre-show CD that I cut together. I usually listen to John Williams' The Mission. That's the NBC News theme, and I love that song. And then I come downstairs, and I usually have a Bible in my hand, which I put on the desk.
Folks, His Honor is one of the pleasures. It's true Chicago. And for those of you who are going to listen to this podcast because you're curious about Chicago theater and your other parts of the country, if you're in town, the directions are on all the websites how to get out to Prop Theater. If you want to know about Chicago and you want to know about what storefront theater, top-notch storefront theater is, you get over to Elston Avenue to His Honor. And I got a feeling this show is already developing legs. How are sales going?
Really good. We're really encouraged by that. It's been very encouraging.
I have two questions.
Of course.
All right. Has Jesse Jackson come see it yet?
No, not yet.
Have you invited him?
We have a political PR person who I believe has extended an invitation to the Reverend. And I've also written Mayor Daley a personal letter inviting him, you know, let him know I loved your father and no way would this dishonor his memory or embarrass the Daley family and that I loved the city. And I wrote it as a love letter. And so I'm looking forward to the mayor attending. And I was always a mayor of Secretary Bill Daley. And I want to, extend an invitation to him, too. No, but I'm going to call Our Lady right now and have her send out some sort of feeler. Please invite him because I think he'd like it. I went to the Daley retrospective, the 50th anniversary, this last April at the University of Circle. And everybody was there, all of the kids, including the mayor. And I remember I was listening to R.W. Apple speak, and it was just when he first started speaking. He was just saying something about the mayor. And Pat Daley, the oldest daughter, she doesn't take a lot of guff. She just stood up and huffed off. And as she walked past her brother Bill, he had his arms folded. And he was just shaking his head. There goes my sis. And I actually went into the bathroom, to go to the bathroom. And there was a shortish man there in a suit. I had a suit on, too, at the urinal. And I made my way to the urinal, and I looked around, and I said, "Oh, hi, Mr. Mayor. Who's the mayor?" And I said, "I flew in from Los Angeles," I said, "because I really want to let you know that I love your father." And he said, "Thank you very much." I said, "My pleasure, sir." I didn't, say to him, "I'm writing a play, going to do a play." No, because it wasn't appropriate at that time.
Well, let me ask you this, because I also said in my review, I kind of challenged the mayor. I said, "You should go see the show, you'll have a deja vu experience, and that you'll be proud." Because I didn't see anything that you could take as negative about the mayor was still accurate. And, he was a controversial, powerful figure, and, no one's perfect. But I think on the whole, it's a tribute to him. But let me ask you the last question.
Sure.
Would you guys arrange almost like a semi-private – the family's big enough.
That's very – interesting that you would say that, because one of my dear friends had suggested to me the way to do it was to do that. And, of course, I would be most amiable for that, definitely. Without any audience members or any press or anything, yes.
Yeah, because I think the unfair thing would be to have the press there.
Oh, no,
as much as I'd love to cover it and interview him afterward, I'd rather have him see it. And then if he did like it and wanted to talk about it, but not, you know, to bushwhack him, because that wouldn't be that would be totally unfair.
No, and I wouldn't allow that. No, the night he comes, even if I know it, and I hope I don't, although it wouldn't affect my performance. In fact, it would probably kick my performance up a notch. But I would never allow any press to make it a thing. Not at all. Not on my watch.
I respect that, because the piece stands on its own. And I only hope that after you have a successful run, that this, obviously you're off to such a good start that I can see that happening, that maybe the storefront downtown would pick it up. Only because I think an awful lot of people, tourists, and all your politicians would sneak in, particularly if you did a Wednesday matinee, or if that was possible, or a Saturday matinee. So many of them would sneak in because they'd be curious.
Yeah, I think they would be curious. Some of them I tried to ask questions during April, but they wouldn't answer. I won't say which.
You know, they're so afraid of him being bushwhacked. You know, that his legacy. And I would too, wouldn't you?
Oh yeah, no. They'll see the review. They'll get, like I said, this is the largest farm town you've ever seen in your life, and we'll start seeing aides coming namelessly through here, checking it out for his honor. And they'll let him know, oh, this, you know, this is a loving port. He was a complicated man. He was a great man. That's why I love complicated people. So
he was, and he appeared to be, he appeared to be contradictions, but the main thing was he was an honorable man. He loved the city, and he did, in his rigid thinking, he did what he thought was right. And the man had integrity, and I don't think you can ask for more.
No, I started seeing, not that I've had my low moments in life. You know, I haven't acted quite the gentleman, but there's ways. I identify with him a lot in my own life. You know, my idea of a big time is a buffet supper. You know, they got a really for those who want to come visit us, we got a really nice all-you-can-eat Chinese joint right down the street there on Addison.
Well, congratulations, and thank you, Neil. This has been great.
Thank you so much.
Well, there you have it, another exhilarating episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. But of course, I can't let you leave without your Shakespeare quote of the week. The following quote comes from Anthony and Cleopatra, Act 3, Scene 4. If I lose mine honor, I lose myself. Well, thank you for sticking around and listening to this portion of the podcast, because that means you've listened to every portion of the podcast. Check us back out next week, because every Monday we have a new exhilarating podcast episode ready for your ears. I'm Dustin Moat from the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, asking you to go see a play this week.